just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass
descent. These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, January 29th, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
Silence is not an option.
The Green Party critiques mainstream anti-war groups for backing off from immediate withdrawal. Violence reignites in Kenya, and a close look at Bush's State of the Union address with Laura Flanders. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. And we are back on the air after several days of struggling with transmitter problems because of the weather. So I really thank all our listeners for your patience. And if you'd like to hear any of the material that we aired on Friday, for example, please do check our website, uprisingradio.org, for archived online segments, as well as kpfk.org for any archived interviews or your favorite shows that you might have missed. Last Friday, Democratic Congressman Dennis Kucinich announced his decision to drop out of the race for the presidency. A long shot to win the Democratic nomination, Kucinich will now shift focus on winning his seventh term in Congress. To the left of the major Democratic Party candidates, the Cleveland congressman made his second bid for the nomination as he felt his party was not acting decisively enough to end the war on Iraq. The criticism is not only shared by Kucinich, but also by the main alternative third party, the Green Party. The Greens are also critical of groups such as MoveOn.org and Americans Against Escalation in Iraq for their recent decision to scale back anti-war efforts. A recent K Street meeting between some anti-war groups concluded with the adoption of a strategy to push legislation to prevent President Bush from entering long-term agreements with the Iraq government. The tactic turns away from seeking to end the war through more front means, such as bills aimed at cutting funding. The Greens see the move as a retreat that can only lead to continued war. My guest is Daniel Breznov. He is a clinical social worker and a former congressional candidate for the Green Party. Welcome to Uprising, Daniel.
Oh, good morning, Sonali. I'm very glad to talk with you.
So first, let's talk about what it means for the Green Party that Dennis Kucinich is not in the race anymore. Did it have any impact within the Green Party? Was there a dialogue among party members?
Oh, I don't know that it has such an impact other than perhaps that he's a sort of sentimental favorite. He's a Democrat, and the reason Greens are Greens, I think, for many of us is that we long ago lost faith in the Democratic Party to really represent a progressive movement, a working class movement, or a real alternative to the pro-capital two-party system. So, you know, from people that I'm talking to, we all sort of are sad because we like him personally, most of us. I think he's a good guy and agree with a lot of what he says. But, you know, we're Greens. We're not Democrats.
Now, but wasn't Kucinich essentially the only voice in the field of candidates that got even the tiniest bit of news attention? Certainly wasn't enough, according to most folks, but certainly he got a little bit more attention than other radical anti-war candidates. And does his absence now mean that essentially nobody will be talking about complete and immediate withdrawal?
Well, you know, except a lot of the voters, right? I mean,
right.
Because we if you were listening to Ron Paul speak at the last Republican debate, he got a huge spontaneous round of applause, and he's been doing that all over the country. And listen, I'm not a Ron Paul fan, but you know, even Republicans are responding to mm-hmm. this very strong anti-war message. So I think people, American voters, want to get out of Iraq. We've been trained to have very little faith and to kind of settle for these people in their suits and ties who are going to continue things as they are. So, you know, I think that the anti-war sentiment is still out there. Yes, we're disappointed it won't get quite the little bit of attention it was getting with Dennis up there. But, you know, again, I don't see it as really a big fundamental difference. It was sort of an inevitability is how it looked, right, from the start that mm-hmm. Dennis was going to mm-hmm. at some point have to go away and let John, Hillary, and Obama do their to their centrist thing.
Especially since he wasn't being allowed into any of the major televised debates.
Yeah, which is ironic, too, that the Republicans, I mean, I know Ron Paul does a little bit better than Kucinich was doing in the polls, but he's been at the debates and he's gotten a lot more attention. You sort of expect the Democratic Party to be more of an inclusive big tent, but the Republicans are sort of showing up the Democrats on that one.
So, Daniel, let's talk about what happened at this recent meeting I mentioned of anti-war groups in Washington, D.C. that is cited in a Green Party press release. What was this meeting all about?
They're looking at strategy. I think, you know, I'm not involved with those groups, so I'm not exactly sure what goes on behind closed doors. I just know the final product. But I have felt for a long time, and I know a lot of Greens have known for a long time, that MoveOn.org is nothing but a Democratic Party cheerleading group, and they're not even really liberal Democrats or progressive Democrats. It's pretty mainstream, maybe a little to the left of the party center, but that's not really saying much. So, I think these meetings were just, again, sort of an inevitability. These folks are Democrats, and they're going to support Democrats. When the Democratic Party candidates show that they're not serious about getting out of Iraq anytime soon, then these groups are going to follow. And, it's really a sort of tail wagging the dog thing.
Hmm. So what about MoveOn.org in particular? This is an organization that, you said they're not even progressive Democrats.
I don't consider them progressive Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Now, they've been very successful in gathering millions of members throughout the country and have these very aggressive email communication with their members. And they're also pretty open about, or at least they seem to be open about, trying to go in the direction that their members want them to go into. You know, their email messages say, well, you asked for this, and so we're delivering, et cetera. Why do you think MoveOn is taking this sort of position, and is it at all reflective of their members?
Well, I don't know all the internal workings. I mean, let's take their word for it that when they send out these emails and tell the members, tell us what you want us to do, let's take their word and say that they're being honest about it. There's still a way in which, and this is with any kind of media communication, that they create the conversation. They kind of create, I think, the choices for their members. They've been around now, must be almost 10 years. And so there's a sort of self-selecting process. I think the people that are paying attention to MoveOn, again, they're sort of mainstream Democrats, and so that's what's going to come out the other end. I think those people, they support the Democratic Party, and, so that's what you're going to get. I've never been really impressed with any of the issues they've taken on. And look, the result is here, they're supporting, either going to support John Edwards, Hillary Clinton, or Barack Obama, none of whom, to me, represent a real solution to the fundamental problems of American capitalism and imperialism.
So MoveOn has specifically called for the presidential candidates among the Democrats to, quote, be unequivocal in their commitments to remove all U.S. troops within 18 months of taking office. 18 months is a year and a half of taking office. So basically they're saying that it's okay for the troops to be in there at least until, what, 2010?
Yeah, and I mean, 18 months from January 2009 mm-hmm. is a long time from now. We have such a short memory in our culture. These candidates can agree to that. They can promise it, and then they can get in office, and then 12 months go by, 18 months go by, and the troops are still there. And what's MoveOn.org going to do? I mean, what are they going to say? You broke your promise? Okay. Are they going to all of a sudden start supporting the Green Party? I'm doubtful about that. What they're going to do is they're going to justify it, or they're going to say, okay, we're disappointed, but we still have to support the president. Because I have a feeling that, if history is any indication, these groups that are now opposition groups like MoveOn.org, and I use the word broadly, opposition, when the Democrats are in party, they're going to become apologists for power because, hey, we have to support President Obama, otherwise we're going to end up with Rudy Giuliani in 2012 is what they're going to tell us. So we've seen this all before. I think we've seen this all before when the Democrats are sort of the insurgent party. We all we can speak with this very strident rhetoric, but as soon as they're in power, we're going to start apologizing for them.
My guest is Daniel Breezenoff, a clinical social worker and former congressional candidate for the Green Party, and we're talking about the Green Party's critique of mainstream anti-war groups like MoveOn.org and Americans Against Escalation in Iraq for their recent decision to scale back anti-war efforts in the context of the primary elections. So let's talk about the Green Party a little bit in the last few minutes of our interview. We had played on KPFK the recent debate that was held in San Francisco among Green Party candidates. Also on Uprising, we played an excerpt of the speech that Ralph Nader gave at that debate. Can you tell us who the main contenders are for the Green Party, and what are a couple of the main issues on the Green Party's agenda for this election?
Let's talk about issues rather than contenders, and the reason for that is that I'm not wanting to. There are some of the very unavoidable challenges of grassroots democracy face the Green Party, and I have to say, particularly in California. We're a big tent. We want voices to get heard, and so sometimes that can be really challenging if you're not willing to sort of shut up the people who maybe not in the majority but have something important to say. And so I'm wanting to kind of stay very far from where the firing is going back and forth between the different sides. But in terms of issues, my number one issue that I've been pushing and that I think the Green Party needs to continue pushing is a program for sustainability in this country. I sometimes call it a New Deal for sustainability, something like that. We talk about fuel standards going 10 miles per gallon up, when we talk about 1%, 2% solar power. And these are ridiculous non-starters. By the time they would be implemented, greenhouse gases and environmental destruction is going to be fivefold what it is now. So we're really just talking about slowing down a crashing train. We need people in the federal government and in state governments who are going to put all the resources of government into building a sustainable infrastructure for this country. When we want to go to war, or when they want to arrest, medical marijuana clinic owners in Riverside, the government springs right into action. They're very, very efficient. But here we're talking about decentralizing the energy grid and making sure that Americans can meet their energy needs mm-hmm. without dependence on utility companies, international oil companies. Everything moves very, very slowly, and they pat themselves on the back for goals that are going to be achieved supposedly in 2020 or 2025. Right. So this to me is the number one thing that the Greens need to push. We ought to be seen by all people in the United States and around the world as the number one advocate for the environment. And I don't think, right now people see Al Gore as the number one advocate for the environment. And that ought to be the Green Party. That's number one. Number two, we need to get the troops home. We need to build relationships with these nations, with the working people of these nations, rather than with former CIA assets who have come into positions of power in Iraq and Afghanistan. We need to be building relationships with the working people of these countries so we can actually have an international solidarity. That's really what democracy is going to look like. The capitalist interests are very much internationalists. They don't care about boundaries, so we need to do the same thing.
Well, Daniel, unfortunately, we're out of time, but there's certainly you've certainly sparked an interest, in a further look at what the Green Party agenda is and what some of its challenges are in the upcoming year. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Sonali.
Daniel Breezenoff is a clinical social worker, former congressional candidate for the Green Party. You are listening to Uprising, and later in the hour, we'll go live to Kenya to take a look at the reignition of more violence there, and we'll hear this radical day in history. And after this week's Empire Notes, we will dissect Bush's final State of the Union address, which he gave yesterday. Stay tuned. Empire Notes are weekly commentaries filed by Rahul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance and The New Crusade. Today's commentary is about the Israeli siege of Gaza.
I have a suggestion for Hamas and other militant groups in Gaza. Stop your ridiculous rocket attacks into Israel. I'm not saying this because they're effectively terroristic, indiscriminate attacks on the civilian populace. Although they are, the arguments that the Qassam attacks or Hezbollah's Katyusha attacks in northern Israel during the 2006 Israel-Lebanon war are inherently terroristic because the targeting technology is so poor seems to suggest that only advanced militaries with GPS-guided bombs are allowed to conduct a war. I'm also at a loss to understand why idiotic rocket attacks that may possibly, by sheer weight of metal, occasionally scratch a civilian, are inexcusable, but the deliberate sustained siege of an entire civilian populace is not. According to an op-ed by Sarah Roy and Ayad al-Sarraj in the Boston Globe, since June, out of roughly 9,000 different commodities that used to enter Gaza before the siege was imposed in 2006, only 9 have been allowed in. Daily imports of flour allowed are about 5% of what's needed. 87% of Gazans live below the poverty line. This is not exactly the Nazi walling in of the Jewish ghettos. The starvation there was far worse and the endgame was different, but it is the closest modern approach. And to say the least, there's more of an international culture of human rights around these days than there was 70 years ago, for all the good that's doing the Gazans. No, the main reason the Qassam attack should stop is that they're playing the Israelis' game. Even before Hamas won the elections in 2006, the Israeli plan was to isolate itself from Gaza, absolve itself of even the minimal obligations it respected as an occupying power, and attain near-complete freedom of military action in dealing with future potential problems. They didn't need more of a plan than that because they decided Gaza, unlike the West Bank or the Golan Heights, was almost worthless to them. Since the elections, and especially since the clashes between Fatah and Hamas and the splitting of the Palestinian territories, the plan has been an addition to squeeze the populace so hard that it gives up on having its own political representation and happily accepts a government, that of Mahmoud Abbas, that collaborates with Israel and eventually signs for a two-state solution of the kind that Israel wants. This plan, conceived in even harsher terms by the Bush administration, which decided in 2006 that Palestine was part of the global war on terrorism, has been carried out with minimal international outcry and indeed with substantial international support. Hamas did make some bold and creative initial attempts to present its international case. After the elections, Ismail Haniyeh told the Washington Post, apropos of the endless questions about recognizing Israel, quote, which Israel should we recognize? The Israel of 1917? The Israel of 1936? The Israel of 1948? The Israel of 1956? Or the Israel of 1967? Which borders and which Israel? Israel has to recognize first the Palestinian state and its borders, and then we'll know what we're talking about. There were signs that Hamas might drop the bloodthirsty rhetoric and start communicating in the language, duplicitous as it is, of international respectability. Unfortunately, that's all been sabotaged, in part because of the U.S.-Israeli response to the elections, with Europe and the Arab nations as accomplices, and in part because of internal power struggles in Hamas. The current strategy of continuing to fire rockets that never hit anything is not resistance. It is rather all that Israel needs in order to continue its policies, to legitimize its claim to treat Gaza as an enemy entity rather than an occupied nation to which it has certain humanitarian obligations. I wouldn't presume to tell the Gazans whether the political goal they should fight for right now is simply an end to the Israeli siege, or a preservation of the shards of the Hamas government and of their democratic right to pick their own representatives. I'm just saying either goal would be better served by an end to the rocket fire. Gandhi's advice to the Jews faced with Nazi exterminism was to oppose openly and nonviolently so as to arouse the conscience of the world. Naturally, this disgusts most people who hear it, and it's certainly not clear it would have saved the Jews. It might, however, not have turned out worse than the eventual strategies followed by most Jewish communities. In order to have any chance at a better future, the Palestinians need the conscience of the world just as much, and the conscience of Israelis too. For Empire Notes, this is Rahul Mahajan.
Empire Notes is online at www.empirenotes.org. Welcome back to Uprising. Despite a visit from former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, violence in Kenya has reignited, with dozens of people being killed and thousands displaced in the last 5 days. Annan intends to mediate between President Mwai Kibaki and opposition leader Raila Odinga over the controversial and contested results of a recent election. Odinga's party, the Orange Democratic Movement, insists that the election was rigged in favor of Kibaki, a view widely held followed by local and foreign election observers. Most of the attacks are split along ethnic lines, with members of Kibaki's Kikuyu ethnic group clashing with members of the Luo and Kalenjin groups that favor the opposition. Thousands of internally displaced refugees have crowded the road from Nakuru to Nairobi. The fighting has spread to Naivasha, home to Kenya's lucrative flower exporting industry. Women and children have become the target of sexual assaults. Many fear the violence could get out of control and lead to a civil war. To date, more than 800 people have been killed in the worst violence since Kenya's independence. Joining us on the line this morning, live from Kenya, is Gem. He is an analyst currently based in Kenya. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us today. First, can you tell us exactly what is happening in Kenya as of this morning? What is some of the latest situation there?
Okay, it's evening in Kenya now, but this morning there was killings happening in different towns around the country, tribe on tribe, more or less. People from certain tribes moving out of certain estates which are dominated by other tribes. One MP was killed last night, so there was a bit of fracas outside his house in the morning as well. That's really what was happening in the morning.
So is the basis of the violence essentially that people are angry that Raila Odinga's party has not been given the presidency, that Odinga himself is not president? And if so, what is the why is it along ethnic lines in particular?
Okay, I think the final thing that got it going was the election and Raila not being the president at the moment. But I think some of the issues that brought it to where it is have been there for the last 50, 60, 100 years. Really long-running issues about resources, land, jobs, access to financials, just the things that people need to improve the quality of their life. So in all the communities, you have a lot of people, especially young people, who lack opportunities to make their lives much better. In brief, I guess that's what's there apart from the election.
What are some of the dynamics then between these various groups, historically and currently?
Okay, some of the best land in Kenya is in the Rift Valley, where most of the fighting is happening. After the British left at the end of colonialism in the early 1960s, it's really a lot of the people from Central Province, Kikuyus, who managed to get most of the land that before the British came was Kalenjin land. And that has been simmering below the surface for the last 50 years or so. And this is one of every election time, it kind of simmers up into tribal clashes. This time, I guess they've just been a lot bigger than they have been in the last two or three election periods. Really, the Kalenjin want their land back, and the Kikuyus have moved in there and settled. And some Kikuyus have been there for two, three generations. And really don't know their original home in central Kenya.
We also have on the line with us LA-based filmmaker Amy Williams, who had joined us in studio a couple of weeks ago. She is currently back in Kenya. Welcome back to Uprising, Amy.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So, Amy,
can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you just fine. So we've been talking to Gem about some of the ethnic violence and some of the historical context behind that. Can you tell us, Amy, a little bit more about what's currently happening and how is the Kibaki government responding to the violence? I understand that there is some talk about deploying the military, but he's reluctant to do so.
Well, actually, we just came from an event where Kofi Annan was announcing the rules of engagement for the negotiations between Kibaki and Raila, and he announced that he was going to build 42 new police stations throughout the nation and spend millions of shillings to help beef up the security, which is sadly needed. We did see evidence of military presence in Nakuru when we were on the ground. The town was being patrolled heavily. And we went into an area, I don't know how much you've been with Gem, but we went into an area where an entire neighborhood had been burned to the ground. And both Kikuyu and Kalenjin were suffering and, were homeless and were carrying all their belongings and trying to find shelter and trying to find a place that was safe.
So who are the main perpetrators of the violence? Is it organized? Is it random, Amy?
You know, I... I'm not an expert, and it's a very, very complex situation. What I'm just witnessing as a filmmaker is that it's a lot of different factions. It doesn't seem that organized, although it seems to flash up overnight. There was an MP actually assassinated in Nairobi this morning, so pockets of Nairobi have now erupted again, and they were kind of quiet for about a week. His name is Weru, and he's from the Mbakazi constituency, and he was part of the opposition team. He was elected in ODM. So that's caused something happens, and then there's a retaliation. And it's too simplistic to say it's Luo versus Kikuyu or it's Kalenjin versus Kikuyu. I think the reason I wanted you to speak with Gem is because I think it's historically really interesting to look at it as land issues and land ownership issues.
Hmm. In fact,
to tribal.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, Gem. You did begin to address some of these issues, but is there any kind of sort of organized demand, or is it simply focused on wanting to get the particular presidential candidate in power, whether it's Raila Odinga supporters or Kibaki supporters who want him to remain in power? Is it that simple, or are people asking for a redress of longstanding issues such as land?
I think even in the recent, a couple of hours ago, there was this meeting between the president, Raila Odinga, and Kofi Annan. And really, they divided the issues into the immediate, urgent ones and the longer-term issues. I think both issues are there. People want to solve the immediate issues of who is the president and who won the election. But the deeper issues, which are really, I think, the source of the violence, also need to be dealt with. And I think given the time frames they've given, people agree that those issues will take longer than a couple of weeks to sort out.
But what about on the ground, people on the ground themselves? Is there a specific agenda that they are looking for, or is the immediate desire to simply have either Odinga get into power or Kibaki remain in power? And is there any sentiment for a unity government, which was being briefly talked about?
Okay, first I'd say for a lot of the Kalenjin violence in the Rift Valley, having Raila as president is part of it because they see Raila as part of getting the justice back.
Mm-hmm.
But an even deeper one, which I think is a stronger one, is to get the Kikuyus out of the Rift Valley or to get redress for past wrongs they perceive the government has done to them, the Kikuyu-led government has done to them in the Rift Valley. In terms of the violence that continues, it starts with a very good reason, then it becomes tit for tat. You know, Kikuyus organize and kill Kalenjins. Kalenjins revenge and go and kill them. So, it sparks and cools down, based on different things at different times. There are reports of some gangs being organized and paid by politicians. Some things are spontaneous. All different kinds of things are going on. It's impossible for anyone to know for every single incident of violence what really was running up behind it.
Yeah, does Kofi Annan's presence signal any hope among Kenyans that there might be a resolution of the problem soon?
I think it's good to have him here because at least twice he's managed to bring the main protagonists together. People would like the process to go a little bit faster than it seems to have been going thus far, but I guess it's the way he's, he knows how to do his business.
Hmm.
They're talking about a four-week process on the short-term issues and a one-year process for the long-term issues. But I hope that the violence won't last for another 4 weeks. In 4 weeks' time, Kenya would be completely ablaze.
Amy, let's talk about the violence against women and girls. When we had you on in Los Angeles in our studios, we talked about the role of women and really the untold story of women in the Kenyan elections. But there has been, with the ongoing violence, of course, an increase in attacks against women and girls themselves. What have you seen or heard about on the ground?
Well, it's interesting. It's definitely an underreported story, the violence that has been perpetrated against women. Rape is definitely widespread. There's an image that just sticks clearly in my mind that is being played over and over on the television and the newspapers of women carrying entire mattresses and bed frames on their backs, the burden of these huge, what little they have, they're fleeing with on their backs. And for me, that's a metaphor for the poverty that they have to carry on their backs. And when we took Stella up to school, the young girl who was on your program a couple of weeks ago, in Nakuru, and it's an all-girls school, all tribes. There's some Sudanese and Somali women at the school, and we interviewed these girls, and, you know, as we're interviewing them, we hear gunshots just less than a kilometer away, and they're crying and they're pleading for peace, and they're saying things like, we sleep with our certificates at night so that if we have to run in the night, we'll have the one thing of value, our education. So as, you know, as these skirmishes are going on, which, by the way, are all young men, we have to see any young girls participating in the violence, you know, people are just trying to go about their lives and they're trying to stick to their dreams. And for a young woman in Kenya, it's about that education.
Finally, Amy, given that you have a history with Kenya, you've been there many times, visited before, this is probably the first time you're seeing this level of violence in that country, what do you say to the assessment that Kenya could plunge into a civil war?
Again, it's something I would never like to exercise an opinion on because it's really not my place. I think personally, just going through this, it's opened my eyes to just how vulnerable any country can be when there's no rule of law, when elections are tampered with, and I just don't believe that it's a specific thing to the African continent. And you know, democracy is a very precious thing, and there are many, many peace-loving, democracy-loving Kenyans that are working very hard behind the scenes, and there's wonderful stories of people reaching across tribal lines and ethnic clashes to shelter each other, to feed each other, to take clothing into the camps. That's the sort of stories that we're working on and hope to bring to the broader public.
Well, Amy Williams, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and also Gem joining us, both of them live from Kenya. Thanks so much for being with us and sharing this information.
Thanks, Sonali.
Amy Williams is an LA-based filmmaker and correspondent for Uprising while she is in Kenya. Also joining us on the line, an analyst by the name Gem. He wanted to go by his first name only. And both of them joined us live from Kenya. You are listening to Uprising. And after this radical day in history, we'll be joined live in studio by Laura Flanders to dissect Bush's final State of the Union address. Stay tuned.
If you believe in democracy, if you believe in free speech and independent media,
don't believe the hype.
KPFK.
On Monday, February 4th, ICUJP, Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, will be hosting a program called Demonizing the Other, starting at 7 p.m. at the Omar Ibn al-Khattab Foundation, located at 1025 West Exposition Boulevard near the USC campus. This discussion will focus on the historical need for creating a victim to rally the country to war, from Native Americans in the early United States to the demonizing of Muslims for the current war on terror, and the need to chart a course away from bigotry to reconciliation. Featured speakers will include KPFK's own Sonali Kolhatkar, host of Uprising, as well as experts on Muslim persecution and the conflict rising in Iran. That's Monday, February 4th, at the Ibn al-Khattab Foundation, ICUJP's Demonizing the Other. For more information, call 626-683-9004 or visit kpfk.org. KPFK is a media sponsor for this event.
People, the time has come.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, January 29th, in 1863, the Bear River Massacre occurred around present-day Utah. 3 years before this, a group of Shoshone under Chief Bear Hunter were forced off their land by Mormon farmers. When the young men of the tribe retaliated against the white settlers, American armed troops were called on to punish the Shoshone. The Shoshone fought back until their ammunition ran out, at which point American soldiers rushed them and began shooting. About 250 Shoshone were slain, women were raped, and American soldiers used axes to bash in the heads of already injured women and children. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Hi, I'm Arundhati Roy, and you're listening to Uprising with Sonali Kolhatkar.
Welcome back to Uprising. In his hour-long final State of the Union address, President Bush yesterday spoke about a large variety of issues, from the economy to taxes, healthcare and education, trade, and the U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. More specifically, he called on Congress to pass his tax rebate package, announced a modest $300 million scholarship money for low-income children, lauded successes in Afghanistan and Iraq, and completely ignored the Israeli siege of Gaza. Although the state of the economy is topmost in the minds of most Americans, Bush only briefly touched on it and instead spent far more time discussing Iraq. The speech was interrupted nearly 70 times by applause. Democrats responded to Bush's final address by calling it, quote, little more than the status quo. And yet, officially, the party called for unity. Joining me in studio this morning to take a deeper look at what Bush had to say yesterday is Laura Flanders. She's the author of Blue Grit, Making Impossible, Improbable, and Inspirational Political Change in America. We had featured it on Uprising. The book is just out in paperback. She's also the host of Radio Nation, and she's currently in Los Angeles for a speaking event to promote the paperback edition of her book. Welcome to Uprising, Laura.
Oh, great to be with you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us and for battling LA traffic to get to us.
Well, the fun part about that speech last night was the first part that you mentioned, which was that it was the final one. Hooray. But really, what a sad sack swan song laundry list.
Oh.
Not of the things we need, but of what he wants.
Right.
I mean, the extraordinary thing was the way that George Bush said in one of the clips I've heard all morning on the headline news in that traffic, around the kitchen tables of this country, people are worried about the economy. Well, he wasn't. He was worried about earmarks, wiretaps, and his own security. At one point he said, we must secure the safety of the U.S. citizen. And I think he meant himself. I mean, eartaps, that is the GOP are the king of eartaps. 9 out of 10 of the top pork winners are Republicans in the House and Senate. Wiretaps, he talked about the importance of privacy of personal records in the medical field, but not when it comes to the security of our computers and our cell phones and our telephones where we live. Obedience was there, I think, between the lines. If you challenge me on further funding of this war, once again, he dredged up that old specter of you're not supporting the troops. And I just wished there had been some courage among those veterans' families and military families in the audience to have made some kind of gesture when he said, we will make sure all the troops get everything they need. They've never had everything they need on his watch.
It was quite difficult and sickening to watch this speech, you know, 70 times applause. I mean, it's just, you sort of wonder, you know, how people can sit through it. And his, it was an amazing exercise in doublespeak and also just twisting of facts. I want to play a clip yesterday from the beginning of yesterday's speech, near the beginning, where he talked about, you know, his little bit of talking about the economy. He, of course, had to talk about taxes. And I love how he explained how it was important to keep the tax cuts that he had brought in to keep them permanent, because somehow that would benefit all Americans. Let's take a listen to President Bush.
Some in Washington argue that letting tax relief expire is not a tax increase. Try explaining that to 116 million American taxpayers who would see their taxes rise by an average of $1,800. Others have said they would personally be happy to pay higher taxes. I welcome their enthusiasm. Pleased to report that the IRS accepts both checks and money orders.
That was President Bush attempting to make a joke, but
Laura, I don't think it flies any longer. I mean, that has been his ploy from the start. Let me pose as the working man's friend against those wealthy magnates. Let them send a check to the IRS if they want. The fact that he mentioned this sort of $1,800 increase that might be felt by those who were benefiting from the health tax was extraordinary. I mean, the tax cuts was extraordinary because that's almost exactly the amount that average wages for working people in this country have gone down on his watch, from about $49,000 to about $48,000. There is simply no question. John Edwards is right. We need to listen, finally, to those in this country who say they have no resources, they're not paying taxes, no rebate will help them, and they can't spend their way out of the recession, no matter how much the Federal Reserve might want them to, because their credit cards are maxed out. I think the reality utterly overwhelming. harmed anything Bush had to say.
And it's amazing when you call in, you know, when you invoke an average. I mean, yes, if you average the incomes of millionaires with those of working Americans, maybe $1,800. But for most of us, $1,800 increase in taxes is really, I think, unrealistic for him to mention. But it unfortunately seems to, you know, people hear that and they swallow it without thinking.
Although I don't know. I mean, I have to say, Sonali, that I've been traveling around the country with the book Blue Grid and looking at what is happening in this country, and I think people aren't swallowing this anymore. I think this was the least, there was the least interest around this State of the Union address than any of his previous speeches. The contrast couldn't be greater, the kind of dead interest in this president and what he has to say versus the kind of turnouts we're seeing in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina last week, double the turnout in the Democratic primary. People have had enough of this. The only thing I would caution folks is that there is some stuff worth listening to in what Bush is saying, in that it is still it still has the ability to frighten me. When he talks, for example, about an overview protective mission or a protective overview mission in Iraq, that sounds like a new agenda. That sounds like decades of deployment in the place. And when he tries to just purvey lies, and this is something I'm sure you've talked about, Sonali, about what's happening in Afghanistan today, well, then he is really telling the American people the reality, turning for the American people reality on its head. This is dangerous stuff as well as stupid.
I want to talk specifically about Iraq and Afghanistan, but first let's go back to the earlier part of his speech where he talked about healthcare. Now, healthcare is supposed to be a huge issue in, you know, this year for Americans at least. You know, it remains to be seen whether candidates will bring it up, and I'm sure it's come up in your conversations with Americans around the country. Let's take a listen to what Bush had to say about healthcare.
To build a future of quality health care, we must trust patients and doctors to make medical decisions and empower them with better information and better options. We share a common goal, making health care more affordable and accessible for all Americans. The best way to achieve that goal is by expanding consumer choice, not government control. So I propose ending the bias in the tax code against those who do not get their health insurance through their employer. This one reform would put private coverage within reach for millions, and I call on the Congress to pass it this year.
And that is President Bush again speaking yesterday, his final State of the Union address. My guest is Laura Flanders. She is here in town, and her new book, just reissued in paperback, is Blue Grit, Making Impossible, Improbable, and Inspirational Political Change in America. We'll tell you where she's going to be speaking on Thursday in a moment. But Laura, let's talk about what he just said regarding healthcare. Of course, this is really interesting to how he spins talking about the tax code, and he only talks about private insurance, basically.
Well, unfortunately, everybody's only talking about private insurance. You know, he talks about affordable and accessible, and Hillary Clinton happened to be caught on camera clapping. I'm sure she wasn't the only one. You know, the American people don't need affordable and accessible health care. They need free, nonprofit health care, and we need somebody with the guts to talk about that.
Let's talk about Iraq and Afghanistan, not just what Bush had to say, and it's certainly worthwhile to talk about what the Democrats have to say about these two countries. In Afghanistan in particular, Bush is lauding the success of Afghanistan, but are the Democrats doing any better?
No, and who's talking to the people actually in Afghanistan today who is saying, we have the Taliban back, the warlords are growing, and U.S. arms are fueling yet another rematch? This is, I think, the most shocking part of this speech and the reaction to it, that he could simply present present such a fake picture of Afghanistan and goings-on there and meet almost no resistance, almost no pushback. I don't know what you're hearing from your folks with the Afghan Women's Mission, Sonali, but I'm hearing Afghanistan is well on track to find itself back where it was before the U.S. invaded, but with the difference of more weapons, courtesy of us.
In fact, yes, it's even worse because Afghanistan has very regular suicide attacks today, something that it didn't have even under the Taliban. Let's take a listen to what Bush did say about Afghanistan.
In Afghanistan, America, our 25 NATO allies and 15 partner nations are helping the Afghan people defend their freedom and rebuild their country. Thanks to the courage of these military and civilian personnel, a nation that was once a safe haven for Al-Qaeda is now a young democracy where boys and girls are going to school. New roads and hospitals are being built, and people are looking to the future with new hope. These successes must continue. So we're adding 3,200 Marines to our forces in Afghanistan, where they will fight the terrorists and train the Afghan army and police.
And that is President Bush discussing what's happening in Afghanistan and, in fact, talking about a troop increase in Afghanistan. Laura, this is something that had been in the news a little bit, but it's getting very little attention. Where are the anti-war groups on this?
Well, I think that you raise a very good point. Not only are they not heard loud enough about Iraq, but Afghanistan has virtually dropped off the map. 3,200 more Marines being sent to Afghanistan. How many of those will come back in caskets? And what are they doing in that place with whom? We still haven't accounted for all the millions of dollars the U.S., in the name of encouraging democracy, has given to, misogynist killer warlords of the sort that you've researched for years. Fully funding the troops is a dangerous catchphrase of this administration. And in Afghanistan, where the whole operation has been calculated in dollars and cents rather than in what makes sense, we've got a disaster on our hands just waiting to happen, and frankly, the Democrats better start talking about it, because if things go the way they want, they're going to be there to clean up the mess.
And Laura, you're going to be speaking this Thursday, January 31st, at the UCLA School of Law, I'm sure touching on many of these issues that we're talking about today and more. That's Thursday, January 31st at 12:30 p.m. at the UCLA School of Law, room 1314. At 2 p.m., there'll be a book signing and refreshments, and that's been organized by the African American Policy Forum. Again, that's this Thursday, January 31st at 12:30 p.m. at the UCLA School of Law.
It should be pretty fun with George Carlin. Ari and Kathy Spiller, really a chance for people to speak out before February 5th.
And so my guest, Laura Flanders, will be there. So let's talk about Iraq, which is, of course, what Bush spent the majority of his time on. And it's interesting because, of course, he's talking about the success of the surge. It's almost as though he's living in a different reality. Last year, calling for troops against what most people were saying. And this year, despite the fact that Iraq is still plunged into so much violence, painting this picture of Iraq that looks and sounds so pretty.
Well, again, I mean, it was one of those parts of the speech where anybody who's living in the reality-based community could only sit back and, sputter. It's almost as if Bush is claiming credit for deaths and dying decreasing and hoping that nobody will remember that they increased to the highest point ever in this conflict in the last year. It's kind of like wanting applause for beating your wife less. And I think that's how I felt this whole speech. I felt that here is a man who is not addressing any of the challenges this country faces, is instead simply looking to his own future and hoping that nobody will put the reality of his record up against this mythology he's presenting with his, silly smiling face. With respect to Iraq, though, you raise a very good point in that where is the democratic response? The response I heard last night, even from Barack Obama, talked about, we must withdraw the troops so that the Iraqi government will behave responsibly at last and take, the reins of government. It's a very patronizing picture to paint of a country that you have devastated and torn apart, to suggest that the problem is the occupied rather than the occupation is, I think, the challenge that the anti-war movement faces. We have to change the terms of this debate.
And as I mentioned earlier, speaking of occupation, Bush didn't even mention Palestine. In fact, we don't have time to play the clip itself, but he you know, talked about how there's going to be peace in the Holy Land.
Well,
and
the irony about his non-mention of Palestine was it was in the part of the speech that talked about the defining ideological struggle of the 21st century being the struggle between democracy and terror, and that the U.S. role is to spread hope of the freedom that comes through democracy. And you and I know that when Palestinians voted, the results were not what the U.S. liked, so they wanted to pretend those elections never happened. Any mention or any study of Palestine reveals just how hollow the White House talk of democracy is.
Let's talk about the future. In this year is a very important year for the United States, and you know, Bush wants to leave behind a legacy. The question is, what are Democrats going to do to allow him to, you know, really be realistic, or to allow the country to have a realistic picture of what this president was all about? Or is it going to be like, you know, for example, Reagan's eulogy? What kind of change are Democrats really representing? You know, is Barack Obama, a victory by someone like Obama, really going to signal something new for this country?
Well, I'm going to pick on one tiny detail that I think raises some of the questions that you're pointing to. There was a moment in the speech when Bush called on the Congress to continue their commitment to what he called charitable choice. That's the ability to put government money into church and religious groups in the name of providing public service. This was an initiative, charitable choice, that broke with tradition, I would say broke with constitutional separations of church and state, came into effect under Bill Clinton in the 1996 Welfare Reform Act. And it's exactly the kind of thing that makes you think, huh, don't forget, a lot of the rot that has festered in the Bush administration set in under Clinton years back. What we have to address now, I think you and I and people like us and the people I write about in Blue Grit, is not just changing power in Washington, not just changing the party in Washington, but changing the priorities of the people in that place. The people I write about in Blue Grit aren't working for change in their communities because they want to see a Democratic majority. They've seen 13 months of a Democratic majority. There are more troops in Iraq, more people dying in Iraq. There are more levies rising around more of our cities and our communities. And now it's not just New Orleanians who are losing their homes. It's not just a partisan change we need. It's a policy and priority change. And what I find exciting about Barack Obama isn't Barack. What I find exciting is the movement that he's mobilizing around him that really is moving into a space, opening up a space that makes it possible for progressives to do their work. I just came from Butte, Montana, where it was interesting to me because if Barack Obama's win in South Carolina was just a black thing, it's going down awfully well in Butte, one of the most white and sort of hope-resistant parts of this country, a battered old Montana mining town that hasn't seen a good job in decades. This is a place where I thought if anywhere Barack Obama's words would fall flat, it would be in Butte. But no, organizers there who were having a leadership training from the Montana Human Rights Network were inspired not because he would save them, but because his endorsement of movement building, of organizing, being an organizer himself, opens a space for them to do the work. And they remember that how the right transformed America wasn't by winning the White House. That was the first step. What transformed America was the movement that followed, and I think that's where we're at.
Laura Flanders, thank you so much for joining us today. Laura Flanders, author of Blue Grit, Making Impossible, Improbable, and Inspirational Political Change in America, has just been out in paperback. She's also the host of Radio Nation. She has a new article in this week's Nation magazine, and check out the Nation magazine's website where her article is on the front page. We'll link to it from uprisingradio.org. You can see her this Thursday, January 31st, at 12:30 p.m. at the UCLA School of Law. Law, Room 1314. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, I'd like to quote Winston Churchill, of all people, who once said, "The whole history of the world is summed up in the fact that when nations are strong, they're not always just, and when they wish to be just, they're no longer strong." That's Winston Churchill. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's show after 10 a.m. on our website, uprisingradio.org. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks for listening.